Welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast where we talk about tech, Apple news, rumors, programming, and all things in between. And this time of the year, we're really talking a lot about Apple events, especially this year. There have been so many Apple events, it feels like, three of them, which I think might be a new record for the number of fall events. Or what do you think, Mr. Guy Rambeau?
Hi, John. Yeah, I think absolutely. This is the largest number of Apple events in a single year, probably in the recent history, because they used to have the March event and WWDC in June, then September, and sometimes October, but November and October and September and March and WWDC, that's kind of new, and it's interesting.
Yeah, it really is. But one thing that I really love is that they're letting each event just be as long as it has to be. It's kind of the same philosophy when TV shows went from being primarily made for broadcast television to being made for streaming services. You could adapt the length of each episode to what kind of story you wanted to tell. So one episode could be 1 hour, one could be 45 minutes, and so on and so forth. And we are seeing these with these Apple events as well, where this past event that we're going to talk about today was just 45 minutes long because it didn't have to be longer. So they didn't have to like pad it out with 2 hours of content just because, you know, they sent an invitation to people to go there in person, which I think is just really great that they have that flexibility and that the events just can be as long as they have to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was great. And I really enjoy having these shorter events, which makes our lives easier as well, because we have to record the episode, and this time it happened to be the day we usually record, so it being shorter means we can record earlier and be done earlier and have a better show because of that.
Exactly. We're not all super sleepy, especially me, because I am quite much more ahead in time than you, because I live in Europe and you live in Brazil and time zones are weird, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I realized I didn't actually introduce myself in the intro. You know, I know that maybe most people listening to the show already know who I am because they listen to the show. But for those of you who are first-time listeners, I'm John Sandell and welcome.
I think we should record the intro all over again. That would be better.
A take two? No, we don't have time for that, Rambeau. We have an Apple event to talk about.
Exactly. So let's skip that.
Let's do that. But actually, before we get to the Apple event, you can see that we are really organized here today. You know, we are just recording right after the event. So we are excited to talk about that. But we, of course, need to talk about what we've been up to. So, Rambeau, I know that you might have a interesting story to tell this week around your development on AirBuddy 2, which is shipping tomorrow as we record, and today as people are listening, I guess. So I guess you can say it's available today.
Exactly. Yeah, so this is quite the week. Today it's the Apple event, and we have Stack Trace, of course. Tomorrow I'm shipping AirBuddy, and today for our listeners. And I have a workshop on Thursday I'm giving for a Bitrise, and also some stuff going on in my personal life. So this is quite the week for me. So I tried to relax as much as possible over the weekend because I knew it was going to be quite the week. So
yeah, charge your batteries.
Exactly. I was ready with a build of AirBuddy 2 last week, which made me quite happy that I was able to get the official build that will go out to users ready over a week before the shipping date, the scheduled shipping date. But then something happened. And that's the type of war story that's fun to tell afterwards, but is not fun when it happens. So I don't remember the exact timeline, but after I had already prepared the final build that will go out to users this week, I got a report from a user. And the issue was that with AirBuddy running, the Wi-Fi speed on their Mac would go down drastically. Like, their Wi-Fi would speed test at like 300 megabytes without AirBuddy, and it would go down to like 100 megabytes when AirBuddy was running. So,
oh wow,
that's not good. That's not something I want my users to go through. So I started investigating, and there were other issues with that particular person's setup that I thought might be the issue. Also, especially given that I didn't receive the same report from other beta testers. And keep in mind, I had like over 2,000 beta testers. So, and this was one report after months of beta testing. So I kind of felt like it was not like a widespread issue. And also I couldn't reproduce it here on my initial testing, but also reproduction is always kind of flaky, right? Because you don't have the exact same setup, operating system, machine model, same devices around, same Wi-Fi router, you know what?
Yeah.
That's always a complicated situation.
Yeah, I mean, reproducing bugs is always hard. Even if you have great crash report data, or even if you have great reproduction steps reported by a user, like, because you have to get in that same state, even if it's just within one application. So even if you have a completely self-contained app, like on iOS, for example, you don't have that user's data typically. So you have to reproduce that somehow, get into that state to have that exact code path being hit. Or if it's something like a race condition, that's even trickier, because then you have to make sure that those operations get called in that right order in order to reproduce the bug and so on. But when you're dealing with things like AirBuddy, which is more like a system extension, like we've talked about, that must be so much harder, because you're not just dealing with the state within your app itself, but the entire state of the system.
And the environment of the user as well, like radio waves.
Right, exactly. Do they have a certain display that blocks the Wi-Fi or something like that close by?
Yeah, exactly. And I did notice some stuff like that in that user's report. But the following day, I received the same report from another user. And that's when I kind of panicked.
Right.
Because that's like when you get... It always happens, like, there are some times when you get, like, this one report from one user out of, like, thousands or millions of users, and it's kind of weird, and you never reproduce it, and you just basically, there's nothing you can do, basically. And it's sad, but that's the reality.
You also have to prioritize, right? I mean, if only 0.01% of your user base is encountering an issue, that's going to be inherently less important than something that way more users encounter, especially if it's not like a crashing bug or something that blocks a user flow. I mean, in this case, it sounds like it was pretty severe, because you also don't want to degrade the user experience on the entire system. And we've talked about that, how you've gone to great lengths to make sure that AirBuddy executes fast and runs with like as little memory as possible and as little performance overhead as possible to not degrade the overall system experience. But still, like, you have to be pragmatic. So yeah, I'm interesting to see how this story is going to continue now, given that you got that second report.
Yeah, so when I got the second report, I then started to take it way more seriously, because yeah, like, if it's a single user out of thousands, then okay, but two users, now it's starting to become a pattern. And I decided to try reproducing it again. And this time, it happened on my Mac.
Oh, wow.
And this is when you get really happy, right, when you have a bug, because if you can reproduce it, you can fix it. Like, that's usually the case. Like, if you are able to reproduce an issue, it might be hard, as we're going to talk about, but you are able to fix it. That's basically the prerequisite, is reproduction. And the reason I couldn't reproduce it before, on when I first got the report, was a very unfortunate sequence of events where when I ran the app to try to reproduce the issue, I had a debug flag set, which disabled the part of the app that was causing the issue.
Ah, I see. Yeah, that's a classic one, that when you're running from Xcode in debug mode and you have certain flags that you kind of disable and things, or you enable them during debug, that you get a different environment. And I guess, like, that's a thing that it's such a common mistake, and I make that mistake all the time too. And you have to keep reminding yourself that in order to fully reproduce an issue, you should always run in like the same environment, like we said, but also in terms of like the code that is being compiled as the user. So in release mode, on a real device, and so on and so forth. So yeah, that's such a common issue to encounter when reproducing bugs.
Yeah, definitely. So all right, I was able to reproduce it. But by that point, I didn't know what the problem was. So I ended up thinking about what had changed recently, fairly recently, in the app, because the beta had been going on for months and only now this had become an issue. So it wasn't like the thing that worried me the most is that it was something like related to the app's usage of Bluetooth to track AirPods and things like that, which would be a huge issue, because then like the core feature of the app would be a problem. But it wasn't, fortunately. I started thinking about what had changed, and it turned out that it was caused by the component of the app responsible for allowing multiple Macs running AirBuddy to talk to each other. And also the component that enables Magic Handoff, which we've talked about.
Right. And those are two very recently introduced features, right? So it sounds like you had a regression on your hands.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not sure if it's qualified as a regression, because it wasn't a problem in an existing feature. It was a new feature that caused a problem that didn't exist before.
I would still call that a regression, right? It's still regressing the overall user experience in some way.
Yeah, that's true. And I started doing some research, and this feature was implemented using multi-peer connectivity. And turns out that multi-peer connectivity causes problems with something called coexistence, which is a wireless communications term, I guess. And it's with regards to multiple things trying to use the same antenna at the same time. And when that happens, you might experience degradation. And the problem with multi-peer connectivity is that, it's not a problem with multi-peer connectivity. The problem is that I was using it in a way that it wasn't designed to be used.
You were multi-peering it wrong.
Exactly. So the way it's supposed to be used, but this is of course not documented, and I guess like it's not something that even should be documented. It's kind of like a philosophical kind of thing, is that the way you're supposed to use it is you start browsing for nearby peers and you advertise yourself as peers, you establish a connection, and you close the advertisement and the browsing. That's how you're supposed to use it. And the way AirBuddy was using it as like an agent or a daemon is that it was constantly browsing and advertising.
Right.
And that's what causes the Wi-Fi issue. And the Wi-Fi issue was persistent because it never closed the advertisement or the browsing. And if you did that in the way it was philosophically supposed to be done, then you would advertise for a while and browse for a while, like a few seconds, and you would be done. And through that time, you would have a little bit of degradation, but then it would be over and that's fine. So I first thought about maybe throttling the advertisement and the browsing, but in the end, I started thinking a little bit more, and I remembered that I was actually doing some experiments with using Bluetooth Low Energy to do the same type of communication instead of multi-peer connectivity, which is cool, but it's not as nice as multi-peer, because multi-peer already does a lot of stuff for you, like the pairing and the encryption stuff is all done by the system. But if you're doing it manually through BLE, you have to do it yourself. But the end solution was that I spent an entire day completely rewriting that component of the app to use Bluetooth LE instead of multi-peer connectivity.
All right. So yet again, dropping down to a lower level in order to solve your problems.
Well, this is even more than that. Like, it's completely changing the technology that's used. And I think it says a lot about my architecture that it's well abstracted, that I was able to do that in just a day.
Yeah.
Because if it was like all coupled with the multi-peer and things like that, then I would not have been able to do this. And also, since this is of course going to be using Bluetooth bandwidth and of course some power, even though it's LE, so it's low energy, I actually changed a little bit about how the app works, and this feature is now disabled by default. So you have to enable it manually, because most people don't have multiple Macs. So it doesn't make sense for the app to be constantly looking for nearby Macs running AirBuddy when the vast majority of users are going to just use it on one Mac. So the users who want to use it on multiple Macs can just open the app, open the settings, and check a checkbox.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea, because If it's one thing that I always try to do whenever I'm designing either a user-facing feature or something like a code library, is that if a certain operation is expensive and it's not required, then I always want it to be either lazy, so it only gets executed when the user actually needs it or calls it, or that it's opt-in, so that all users don't pay the performance penalty for that particular feature that is only used by a subset of the user base. Again, whether that's a code library, so the user base is developers, or end users. I guess even with a code library, it eventually ends up impacting the end user experience as well, because the library is going to be included in some product that's going to be run on a user device.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good philosophy to have in general. And so I think you probably made a great decision here to at least initially disable it by default, because you might also figure out later a way to, you know, make it work. Like, for example, it might wake up in certain intervals and scan and then just do the work. And then you might be able to figure out some heuristics around that. So you can have it enabled for all users all the time without having it impact, you know, the overall networking experience. So starting out initially with it being opt-in, I think that sounds like a good call.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a very stressful day because it's not often that you have like, I have to get this done today. It's not common, at least not in the way I work. I know some developers have that sort of pressure, but yeah, I ended up making it and I'm happy that I did. And I think even if the multi-peer stuff didn't have the problem that it had, this ended up being a better implementation.
Yeah, it's one of those things where something bad happened, like a bug report, or I mean the bug report itself is not bad, but the bug is bad.
Yeah.
But it ended up leading to a better solution. So that can sometimes happen as well. I also love, by the way, that you kind of casually rewrote your entire networking stack in a day, like a few days before shipping your product. That is just fantastic. And that is such a Rambo way of developing a product.
Well, to be fair, this is a secondary feature of the app. So it wasn't like I was rewriting the entire core of the app. Like it's just right. Like a subcomponent that enables a secondary feature. So I was fairly confident that it would not be that big a problem. And another thing I considered, and it would have been my solution if I wasn't able to get this done in time, would be to just postpone that feature to the 2.1. Like if Apple can do it, then I can do it as well. If they can postpone features, I can do it as well.
Absolutely. But I'm glad you made it, because I'm really looking forward to trying out that feature once the app gets released.
Awesome. And what have you been working on this week?
So for the past week, I've honestly mostly been doing client work. I mentioned it on a few episodes ago that I have been doing more and more client work recently, and I've been really enjoying it. Like, I've been doing lots of different kinds of client work for the past couple of years, even as I've been working mostly with Swift by Sundell. I've been doing workshops and code reviews and smaller coding tasks for different companies and building prototypes for different companies and things like that. But now I've also taken on more kind of long-term development contracts for the past couple of months, and that's been super fun. So I've been working with teams again and, you know, doing everything like daily stand-ups and code reviews and all those kinds of things. And it's been really, really fun to be part of a development team again, like more, not full time, but like ongoing, right? Not just do like a quick 2 or 3 week assignment and then leave, but to actually be part of a team. So that's been a lot of fun. So with that, I had to spend a little bit less time on my kind of Swift by Sundell work, because, you know, I don't have infinite amounts of time. Mm-hmm. And I always try to balance my free time and my work time and all sorts of things that I do so I don't get overworked. But one thing that I have done during the past week is that I did launch a new edition of my new Discover feature. So this new edition features unit testing. So it's a page that is all about the content that I have to offer around unit testing in Swift. And I've also been continuing my long-term project of redesigning the Swift by Sundell start page. I've been mentioning this as well, that I've been, you know, doing different work on trying to come up with a new design for the start page, because as I've been kind of evolving my work a little bit during the past year, and as I'm continuing to do so, I have some new ideas coming up in the next couple of months as well. I really feel like I need a new start page in order to like make sense of all of that work. Because something that's interesting with Discover, for example, is that ironically, Discover is really hard to discover because there is no link currently on the start page to Discover, which definitely is the plan to do that. But I kind of want to see where this redesign work takes me first so that I can fit it in a nice way. But when I was doing that design work, I felt a little bit like I was going in circles where I was doing some design and I wasn't happy with it. And, you know, it's one of those things where you have to balance all these different trade-offs. And in my case, I have to fit all of this information that I have on one page and make it like easy to get an overview of, easy to navigate, easy to find out like what's the latest articles, or if you want to listen to the latest podcast episode, that should be easy as well. So there's a lot of kind of different things to balance here. And one thing that I started doing, which I felt was really liberating, was that instead of continuing to design things, so I'm using Sketch as my design tool, and I'm putting like all the different things in there and trying to move them around and make sense of them. And in the beginning, I was putting like actual text and icons and actual UI in Sketch and doing that kind of high fidelity type of design. But what I ended up doing now for the last couple of days is that I instead switched completely to wireframes. Mm. So I removed all that kind of high fidelity design stuff that I was working on, and instead just I'm moving around blocks that are more abstract that says like, here's where an article would go, here's where this link would go, here's where a sponsorship would go. And that I feel is very liberating because it lets me move things around much easier. And now I can more easily kind of try to form that holistic view of the page before moving into that more detailed design later, which I feel is a nice workflow with design.
Yeah, I think it kind of, for us developers who also do some design work, it kind of also plays into the abstraction muscle in our brain, right?
Yeah.
You, instead of starting out right with the end product, you start with an abstraction and an overview, like an architectural overview of what you want to design, and then you slowly refine it to make it better. And that's also the approach I've been taking, and it's the approach that works best. Like, first think about the overall structure of things, and then you refine the visuals and actually design the end product.
Exactly. And speaking of like developers doing design, that is something that I really recommend to everyone who is a developer to occasionally at least play around with doing some kind of design. I know that many developers work with designers in their team, so they might not feel the need to do a lot of design, or they might not want to step on the designer's toes, right? And like try to do their work for them. But I think it's really, really useful as a developer to like familiarize yourself with design tools, with the design process, and things like this, like I just talked about, like realizing what kind of design workflow works for you as a developer. Because I feel like the more I do design work and the more I kind of go into that world, the easier it is for me to actually work with designers. So when I'm working with clients, when I'm working with designers on some other project, it's so much easier for me to kind of connect with them because I have this understanding of their workflow and their world and the tools they use and their concepts, so that I can easily translate it into code and we can have that dialogue. So I feel like that's something that's incredibly useful to at least occasionally just like try to practice and train your design muscles, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. I've actually come to realize over time that I actually feel like I think I have a revelation to make, John. I think I'm a designer.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm not saying that in terms of my abilities, not at all. Like, I'm saying in terms of how I think about things. And I'm much more happy creating things and starting out from concepts and making them a reality. It's almost as if I learned how to program just so I could bring my ideas to life, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Like, I would be fine if I had another developer program AirBuddy, but I was just designing it and developing it in terms of the product. I would be totally happy if I didn't have to do the coding.
Oh, that's cool.
And I know many developers don't think that way, but I do.
Right. I mean, I think for me, I've been thinking a lot about this lately because, you know, we had that discussion the other week around, you know, being pragmatic around your development decisions and your tools and what's the most important, like computer science or building great products, right?
Yeah.
And I've come to realize that I'm the most happy on kind of both those two ends of that spectrum. So for example, if I'm going to focus a lot on like kind of the computer science angles or like the elegance of my code or the abstractions and so on, I love to be like really in code mode and work on like the lower level parts of the app. And then if I'm going to be instead in design mode, I like to be as high level as possible and like to work with design tools. And that's why I love Swift UI so much, because it lets me like really work very quickly with UI and come up with these ideas and experiment with them and figure out what I want to build. And then I can write my low-level logic completely separate from the UI. So going back to your kind of learnings around abstractions and how you could refactor, you know, your networking stack in AirBuddy, I feel the same way around abstractions, but for me with kind of context switching. So if I have good abstractions, I can really focus either on just the code parts and the algorithmic sides of the app, or on the UI and the visuals and the product side of the app. So I don't have to kind of constantly jump between the two. I think that's my preferred way of working. And that's why I really love a really good solid abstraction so that I can be in either of those two worlds at any given time.
Nice.
Cool. So now that we've given all of our listeners a little recap of what we've been up to, it's time to jump into our poker results. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's first sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by our friends at Honeybadger, the tool that combines error, uptime, and check-in monitoring for any website or web API into a single, easy-to-use platform. Go to honeybadger.io to get started for free, and if you let them know that you heard about them here on Stack Trace, then they will give you a 30% discount on your license for 6 whole months. Now, more and more teams around the world are starting to embrace the concept of DevOps by continuously integrating and deploying their code and by ensuring the highest possible uptime and quality for their user-facing APIs and services. And Honeybadger can make you a true DevOps hero by letting you monitor that any website or web API that you're working on continues to stay up and running and working as expected. It'll send you automatic alerts in real time if an issue ever occurs, and it will also give you lots of contextual information if that ever happens, so that you can then fix those issues and get your service up and running really quickly. Because we all know that mistakes do happen, but that's exactly when Honeybadger has your back. Honeybadger's included uptime and check-in monitoring also lets you know when any external services that you depend on are having issues as well, or if a background job goes missing or silently fails. And all of this gives you so much more confidence when deploying and running your software on the web, which in turn lets you deploy faster and more often without having to constantly worry about accidentally causing your service to break and for your users to lose access to it. Head over to honeybadger.io to find out more about it and how the team behind it, Star, Josh, and Ben, created a completely bootstrapped monitoring solution that's self-funded by them so that they only answer to you, the developer, their customer, rather than any venture capital firms or anything like that. And if you sign up for a free account to try it out, there's no credit card required, and you then tell them that you heard about them here on Stack Trace, then they will give you a 30% discount on your license as well for 6 months. Once again, that's honeybadger.io, and please remember to tell them that you heard about them here on Stack Trace, because that really helps support mine and Ramble's work and keeps this podcast up and running. Thanks so much to Honeybadger for sponsoring this episode of Stack Trace. All right, Rambo. So before we jump into the actual Apple event itself and talk about all of the exciting announcements, we of course have to go through our poker results. And you might hear that I'm sounding a little bit more cheerful this time when I'm talking about the poker results than last time.
Interesting. I wonder what happened.
So there are two reasons why I'm excited about the poker results. The first reason, which is honestly the biggest one, is that I did not get minus points this time. That's a big achievement for me. So I ended up getting 10 points, which I must say, I feel like it's a pretty big improvement from the like -3 and -1 that I got for the last two events.
Definitely, yeah.
So +10 for me. However, Rambo, you ended up actually getting minus. So you got -1 point. I'm afraid that maybe the minus point curse has been passed on to you.
Yeah, I mean, you can't win everything, right? I'm actually kind of happy that you won this time, because let's be honest, like you were losing so much in these pokers that I kind of felt like you deserve to win at least once this year.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's fun to keep the game interesting, right? Like if it's always like Rambo beats John like for the 50th time in a row, like it's not going to be so much interesting anymore, right? So it's good that we have a little bit back and forth, even though You know, you are generally better than me at this type of thing because you're kind of more tuned into the whole rumor scene and everything that's going on. You know, we all know that. That's kind of your superpower. So I feel really good about this victory. I feel like I played well. I made a balanced kind of gameplay between not betting too much, not being too much betting from the heart, but also like taking some chances. So I feel like it was a good game.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I thought would be really funny if someone had picked would be the I am a PC guy will show up during the event.
Right. If we would have done odds, that would have been like, the odds would be like 1 to 1,000,000 on that. So that would be a big score.
Yeah.
So let's just go through like our bets and what actually ended up happening. So we did bet on that at least one of the Apple Silicon Macs will have a discrete GPU, and none of the ones that were introduced at this event do have a discrete GPU. They all have integrated ones. In fact, they actually made a pretty big deal out of that it's only integrated graphics and just how high performance it is, which we'll get to in just a minute.
Yep.
We also had that long time rumor that Apple Silicon Macs will have touchscreens, and that did not end up happening. We talked about Test Flight being announced for the Mac, and it was not announced during the keynote, and I haven't seen anything about it since either. That being said, we're just like a few hours away from the keynote now, so we might see that being announced in the next couple of days or weeks or something like that. We also were betting on that a Complex app will be shown running under x86 emulation using Rosetta 2, and that definitely happened because they showed both like a high-end productivity tool and a game. Intel was mentioned during the keynote. That's something that we had different bets on. You thought that wouldn't happen, and I thought it would happen for the exact same reason as it did happen, which is to just mention that that Intel Macs are also still there, and not to like talk about that Apple is much better than Intel, but just to kind of mention that there are also Intel-based Macs.
Nice. Yeah, another really cool bet that I thought about right now, but of course I didn't think about it before the event, was that at least one model would be less expensive than its Intel counterpart.
Right.
Which totally happened. And it makes sense that it did, but we'll talk more about it as we talk about the event.
Yeah, we will. We did bet on that some of the new Macs would come in new colors, which did not happen. We did see a new MacBook Air, so that did happen, but we did not see a 14-inch MacBook Pro. Instead, the MacBook Pro remains 13 inches with the same form factor as before. None of the new Macs did get a brand new design, which we predicted, and that also ended up happening or not happening, depending on how you see it. And finally, the question was whether you will be able to pick how much RAM you want to have in your Apple Silicon Mac, and you can pick that. Now, initially, when I scored our game, I thought that I didn't get that point because that was not mentioned in the keynote. But then you're a gentleman, Rambo, and you actually said that I did get that point because it appeared in one of those summary slides.
Yeah, that's true. I think right within the first announcement of the MacBook Air, it showed on the slide that it was configurable. It didn't say the word configurable, but I remember you mentioning that it would say something like up to X amount of RAM, and it totally did in the slide. It said like up to 16 gigabytes of RAM. So in my opinion, you did get the point.
Cool. Thanks for that. Of course, I will gracefully accept the points. So that is our poker results. And now let's actually start talking about the announcements themselves. Let's start like we always do. Like, let's go through it chronologically. And let's start with the intro. So we saw another one of those really nice, beautiful intros. And one thing that I kind of paid attention to this time was the fact that when there's this intro music, like when you turn on the event stream, like maybe 10 or 15 minutes before, there's this like elevator music almost kind of like playing in the background, waiting for the event to start.
But it's not just any elevator music. It's Apple event elevator music.
Exactly. So once the event starts, it perfectly transitions, of course, into the actual event and into the intro itself, which I just think it's such a nice touch that it doesn't just like cut off the elevator music in the middle and then the event starts. It just kind of seamlessly transitions into the event.
Yeah, that's really nice. And also during the intro, when we see Tim Cook, and after he does the recap and they move with him up on like the upper level of Apple Park, the transition there was beautiful. I don't know if they used a crane or a drone or what they used. If it was a crane, it was one of those huge cranes. But it was a beautiful transition as well.
I would be pretty nervous having to fly a drone inside of the Apple Park cafeteria. Like, you accidentally collide with those huge glass doors. That would not be fun.
Yeah, and it was probably a drone carrying like a red camera or something.
Right, exactly. So we had the intro, and another thing that I paid attention to was that Tim Cook was in a different location. He was in the cafeteria, and it kind of feels like with each of these events, they want to kind of showcase a different part of Apple Park, or what do you think?
They're just showing off.
Exactly. So Tim did clarify that the one more thing in the event invitation does indeed mean the Mac, like we were suspecting. And after a little video and after that transition you just mentioned, and then that cool transition where it was going through a bunch of different floors, like going deep, deep underground, and each floor was a different color. I thought that was really nice. Yeah. And then we saw the first Apple Silicon chip, which is called M1.
What a surprise, right? I think we kind of speculated that it could potentially be called that back when all of this was just a rumor that Apple will transition the Mac to Apple Silicon, or ARM, as we called it back then. But many people didn't think this was possible, or not possible, but likely, because it clashes with the motion coprocessor that they use on the iPhone. But I think it's been a while since they've mentioned the motion coprocessor at all. I think this was a marketing play back when, like, the motion coprocessor was news in the iPhone. I think it was back in, like, or S days or something, maybe even before. So I feel like it's totally fair for them to repurpose the M to be the Mac chips. So yeah, I'm happy with the name, and I'm happy that they're not just reusing the same name as the iPhones. I think it deserves its own name.
Yeah, it really does. Maybe it's like Swift modules, where, you know, if you want to name one of your types the same name as a standard library type is named, you can just say Swift dot in front of the standard library in order to differentiate between them. So yeah. Maybe it's like the M1 that is the processor for motion is now the A14.M1.
Yeah, totally.
So, Rambo, tell us a little bit about the M1. What does it have?
So, the M1, it has a 5-nanometer process, 16 billion transistors. So that's quite a few. Also has an 8-core CPU that's divided between 4 performance and 4 efficiency cores. According to Apple, it's the world's fastest CPU core and also world's best performance per watt. And if you don't know what performance per watt is, I think the best explanation of that is in Steve Jobs' presentation of the Intel transition back in, I think, 2005, where he explained what it is and how Intel was back then way better than PowerPC in that area. And now we're seeing Apple's chips are way better than the competition in performance per watt, which is basically like how much juice can you get out of a chip without draining your battery too quickly. And also in terms of GPU, it has an 8-core GPU, 2.6 teraflops, and according to Apple, again, it's the world's fastest integrated graphics. This is quite a lot of stuff, right?
Yeah, and this is without mentioning like all of the other things like the neural engine, secure enclave, and all these things. Like, this is just the CPU and the GPU kind of metrics. And what's interesting here is that in classic Apple fashion, they don't mention like the clock speed, right? They don't mention how many gigahertz these CPUs are. Yeah. And this is an interesting thing also when we're talking about both the CPU and the GPU, because you said that they mentioned many times that it's the world's fastest integrated graphics, because integrated graphics so far, at least in most cases, in most kind of mainstream PC and Mac use cases, has been a kind of low-powered GPU that is only there for like having any graphics capabilities, more or less, right? At least like most of the part, where it's for driving display and doing basic GPU tasks. It's not something that you would use for gaming or for high-end like GPU tasks. But this GPU that is still integrated is quite capable. And like you said, it has 2.6 teraflops of compute. It is an 8-core design. So it's maybe not the most powerful GPU ever made. Of course not. It's not as powerful as the most high-end ones, but it is a capable one. And I think they really needed to emphasize that so that people don't just think, oh, it's an integrated graphics card, so it's going to be weak. And the same thing with the CPU is that with this hybrid design with high performance and efficiency cores, you can't really just put a gigahertz number on it, right? You can't just say, like, this is how many gigahertz it is, and you can just go compare it to any other CPU, because it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that we're now going back, basically, to how it was back when Max used PowerPC, which was a different architecture and even a different style. I don't know if there's a technical term for like RISC versus CISC,
right?
Which is not really a thing these days. At least most people say that it's not really a thing anymore. But you basically couldn't compare Intel and PowerPC directly. And to this day, like, there are still people who say like, oh, this Mac costs whatever, but I can assemble a PC with half the money and it has 2 times the gigahertz, and it's not the same thing. Like, you can't really compare. And even more so now that these Macs will be running Apple's custom SoC, which is not a processor, and many people forget about it. An SoC is a system on a chip, so it is a processor, but it's a processor and some other stuff. And this other stuff and the fact that it's an SoC makes a huge difference. Like, the unified memory architecture, that alone makes a huge difference. And also the integrated GPU, which, again, it's integrated in the sense that it's within the SoC, but it has nothing to do with the integrated GPU that we talk about when we talk about the crappy Intel GPU that's in some Macs. I think in order to be able to compare this to anything else, you really have to use it, basically. And yeah, benchmarks can be useful in a sense to compare numerically. But I'm really not a fan of this numbers game, like megapixels, gigahertz, gigabytes. I'm into, because those actually really do impact us directly, especially in terms of storage. But other than that, like, I've seen, like, there's been like huge discussion on, like, my Twitter feed these past weeks has been all people talking about how many watts whatever charger can put out with the MagSafe and the iPhone, and I really don't care about this stuff. But if you do, more power to you, no pun intended. I think you can't really compare these chips with other chips directly.
Yeah, I mean, I know what people are looking for, and I'm sometimes in certain contexts looking for the same. They're looking for a way to compare products, right? And that's completely fair. Like, that's understandable. Like, when I was buying my fridge, I wanted to compare different fridges. And I was looking at these numbers, and some of them made a lot of sense to me, like simple stats. But there are a lot of things in the fridge world that I don't understand at all. And then I'm like, why don't you just put a number on it so I can compare, right? Mm-hmm. And I understand that people feel this way too about computers, even people who are tech savvy, even people who are programmers, because like we mentioned, things are getting really complex in terms of just like measuring performance just from a number. So you can't just really say what's this particular score. You can use benchmarks like Geekbench, but it's all about how it translates into real life use cases. And that's something that I think we're just going to have to kind of wait and see to see, like, what does this actually translate to in real life usage? How much faster is it going to be to perform tasks A, B, and C? And if those are tasks that you do, then that is going to be beneficial to you. So it is a complex equation, because when we're talking, for example, about machine learning, since we now have the neural engine in these new Macs, machine learning is like way faster. Like, in some of these computers, it's like 10 times faster, because before it was only done on those integrated GPUs, and now it has a completely different accelerator that that those kind of operations can run on. So I think as we're going to see these more kind of intelligent systems in terms of how they distribute work, and as we're going to see more accelerators being added to the mix, things are just going to keep getting more and more complex in terms of measuring something by specs. You're going to have to measure it by use cases. You're going to have to measure it by benchmarks and so on and so forth. So yeah, that's kind of the new world that we're in terms of computers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it makes sense, of course, for people who are into this stuff. It's kind of a bummer that it's not advertised, but it's been this way since forever with the iPhone and iPads and things like that. And let's be honest, like now the Mac is basically a huge iPhone with a more powerful chip.
Right.
And less strict security requirements in terms of what software can run on it. But I love that they mentioned, and we'll talk about software, that, oh, and you can install apps from the App Store or download them from the web. Like, I love that they actually mentioned that during the keynote.
Yeah, me too. It's always nice to hear that reassurance because it's some kind of commitment, right? It's not like, oh, tomorrow you're just going to be able to download from the App Store. It feels like at least for a year forward, we're good for another year, Rambo.
Absolutely. We also had, speaking of software, a Big Sur recap, right?
Yeah, exactly. Craig Federighi was recapping some of the most important parts of the Big Sur release in terms of Apple Silicon. So the fact that you can run universal apps, so you can run iOS apps on the Mac now. And that's when he mentioned Intel. So I was like, yes, you know, thanks, Craig. And then we had Rosetta 2, of course, with the demos we alluded to earlier, like showing how Rosetta 2 can be used to power some really high-end use cases. And they even mentioned that for some apps, they actually run even faster on the Apple Silicon Macs under Rosetta 2, like under emulation, which is, that is just unheard of, right? Like that is really impressive. Like an emulation that is faster than the original.
Yeah, there's a fun number here for people who are into numbers. Someone from Apple tweeted that retaining and releasing an NS object takes about 30 nanoseconds on the current generation Intel, 6.5 nanoseconds on the M1 chip, and 14 nanoseconds on the M1 emulating an Intel, so under Rosetta. So yeah, it is actually twice as fast in that sense, of course, for this particular task being emulated, which is quite incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And this is where Apple controlling the whole tech stack gives them a lot of advantages in this case. So you mentioned their NS object, which is in Objective-C and the Objective-C runtime, which a very large part of the system is built on. Even things that are using Swift are many of them, if not most of them, at least when it comes to the UI, is Objective-C under the hood. So retaining and releasing those objects is incredibly important and super common, right? It happens a lot of times during an application's lifecycle. And since Apple controls the implementation of that, and they also now control the silicon, they can make a lot of those optimizations on like a super low level so that the emulation and the normal runtime just gets really, really fast. So I love seeing these kind of things. And this is where I feel like it's like a decades-long investment that is kind of paying off now.
Yeah, and if you think about all of these little optimizations, which, of course, like, oh, 30 nanoseconds to 6.5, that's not much. It's nanoseconds. But if you consider that that's potentially happening like millions of times per second on an entire system with lots of stuff going on, makes a difference. It pays off. And that's just one example.
Absolutely. And that's a common mistake to make, even as a programmer, is to kind of trivialize those kind of performance gains.
Yeah.
So when you're developing an individual piece of code, you can sometimes feel, it doesn't matter so much if this is going to be slightly faster or slightly slower. And sometimes it doesn't. Like, it's also a thing where you can run into premature optimization if you always focus on these things. So that's also something to be aware of. But in so many cases, if you can make that individual function faster without making it super much more complex or harder to read or harder to test or harder to develop, if you can just make the code itself execute faster, then that will pay off in other parts of the system. So for example, if you have a sorting algorithm and you make that, like, instead of running on a normal data set, instead of being like 3 milliseconds, it's now 0.5 millisecond. Again, that might not seem like a lot, but then you have those users that have huge data sets, or you start running that sorting algorithm on another array or another collection, which then turns it into an O of N operation on top of that. So you end up actually getting those performance gains in the end anyway. So it's important to have like a holistic view of the system, either of our own app or of the, in this case, of the whole operating system as a whole, whenever we talk about optimizations and performance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I mentioned when we talked about optimization in a past episode, how scared I am of hot code paths that run like thousands of times per second potentially. So yeah, that's something I always have to keep an eye on.
Yeah, maybe like the developer equivalent of the game, the hot potato, right? Where you have to pass the hot potato around. Maybe that's the hot code path.
Pass the hot code path. That would be a fun game.
Exactly. So that was the M1 chip, which is very, very similar to the A14, but a little bit adapted to run on the Mac. And of course, because it runs in a different enclosure, it can have some different characteristics. And this is going to be interesting now that we're going to dive into the actual models, because we're going to see that they all run the same M1 chip, but they have different performance characteristics because of their form factor. But before we dive into the products themselves, let's take another quick break to thank this episode's second sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is also brought to you by App Figures, the service that gives app makers the tools that they need to get more downloads and ultimately more revenue. Go to appfigures.com/on/stacktrace to learn more, and then use the coupon code STACK3030 to get an exclusive 30% discount for 3 whole months. You might have already heard about App Figures because of their popular analytics and App Store optimization features. But now, App Figures can do so much more, including giving you insights into how your competitors are doing. Their competitor intelligence feature tracks downloads, revenue, audience demographics, and SDK usage of your app's competitors, which gives you a ton of valuable context when it comes to building your own app and your own features. For example, let's say that one of your competitors just added a new feature or was mentioned in the news. With App Figures, you can see if either of those two things brought in more downloads, which in turn can help you make your own decisions on how to respond to that competitor's move. This feature, and App Figures in general, can also help you with market research before you start building a new project, app, or feature. You can see how big your potential market could be, how much money your new project could end up making, and so on. In fact, Rambo, I think that you've used App Figures yourself for some of these things, am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been using App Figures for years now to track my apps, and especially with Chibi Studio, which has been in the App Store since 2016. I love how it gives me an overview of how the app is doing. It always sends me daily and also weekly and monthly reports, which are configurable. So I'm always on top of what's going on with my app. In fact, I don't think I've told this story, but last year we noticed a significant drop in sales of or in-app purchases. And I was actually able to use App Figures to cross-reference multiple data sources and figure out what happened. So yeah, that's really great, and I really love using App Figures for that.
Yeah, that's awesome. That sounds like a really valuable use case for sure. Now, all of this is, of course, scratching the surface of what App Figures can do. So whether you're aiming to grow an existing app or build a new one, then App Figures has all the tools that you need to reduce risk and to get more downloads. You don't need a large budget or a data science degree to do this kind of thing anymore, because App Figures has made all of this both affordable and simple. Go to appfigures.com/on/stacktrace to try App Figures completely for free. And if you end up liking it, then you can use our special offer code STACK3030 to get a 30% discount for 3 whole months. Once again, the URL is appfigures.com/on/stacktrace. And using that exact URL really helps support this podcast. So please use it if you can. And the offer code is STACK3030, which gives you that discount. Thanks a lot to App Figures for sponsoring this episode of Stack Trace. All right, Rambo, so now it's time to talk about the Macs themselves, and we should start with the MacBook Air.
Yeah, they started out with the MacBook Air, which actually made an appearance before it had been announced, which is not common for Apple events, but I think they really didn't want to miss having the joke where Craig opened up the MacBook Air and it lighted up instantly, and they dimmed the lights for the moment. That was quite a funny moment, and yeah, so usually when they do these events, they don't show the unannounced products until they are actually announced, but this was different. And actually, it's interesting that they mentioned the instant wake-up thing, because I think they promised it for the Mac a while back during the Intel era still, but it's still not quite here. But yeah, that's...
Instant is now more instant.
More instant than ever, and we think you're going to love it.
Exactly.
It's 3.5 times faster and also has a lot of other stuff like better GPU performance, ML... but interestingly, it has no fan, John.
Yeah, that's really cool. It was something that was discussed a lot back and forth when we were talking about Apple Silicon Macs and how they would look like, that probably some computers would not have a fan, and here we go.
Are you a fan of no fans?
Yeah, I am definitely a fan, because, you know, if you can get away with it, not having a fan is great. Like the iPad, it's amazing, and... It also tells you something about how they can manage the heat of the new M1 system on a chip, that it's capable of running in an environment that doesn't have active cooling, which means that they are able to manage the thermals on the chip itself, which is really great. It's just how iPads work, how iPhones work, and so on and so forth. So 3.5 times faster CPU performance, 5 times faster GPU performance, 9 times faster ML performance. Like, good scores, you know, again, these are kind of just numbers, like we have to see when we actually start using real life use cases. But in a fanless enclosure, I think this is pretty great.
Yeah, the fact that they've shown like 4K video being edited in Final Cut Pro says a lot about their confidence in this computer and the chip running in this environment. So I think it will probably be fine, especially for the use cases that people use MacBook Airs more often. And something that I think we should bring up right now, because I know many people and probably some of our listeners are wondering, we didn't talk about the other Macs yet, but they all run the same chip, right? But they run the chip differently.
Yeah.
And that's the key here. And I think it's probably going to be confusing for some people, especially people who are not into chips and ARM Macs and things like that. But yeah, basically what Apple does is they change the profile at which the chip is going to be run at, and they have very advanced management of these chips, so they can... Basically, and people love throwing this term around, basically they can throttle the chip when it's needed. And that's the main difference between like a MacBook Air, which has no fan, and a Mac Mini or the MacBook Pro, which has a fan as well. They can turn on the fan and cool down the chip, and the Mac Mini is larger, so it can run hotter for longer. So you end up getting better performance from the same chip.
Exactly, because if you don't have a fan, then what's the way you can reduce the heat? Like, you can't blow the fan, so you can't blow the hot air out, right? So, I mean, there's going to be some amount of passive cooling just by how kind of the enclosure is designed and how air exits from the enclosure. But if you want to dynamically manage it, the only thing you can do is slow the chip down, right? Like, you can't do anything else. The only thing you can do is limit the amount of operations that you do preemptively, so you don't end up in a situation where the device overheats and has to shut down, right? Because that would be like really bad.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's why these machines have different performance characteristics, even though they are running the same system on a chip.
Yeah, the best way to explain it is think about an incandescent lamp, one of those old lamps which we don't use anymore, hopefully. If you ran it brighter, it would heat up more. And it's like the chip. You have to turn down the brightness and make it cooler. That way you can't, if you don't have a fan blowing air over the lamp so that it doesn't blow up. That's basically how it works.
Right, exactly. And all of this kind of energy management that these chips have baked in, and that they are so efficient in terms of performance per watt, like you mentioned earlier, also leads to what looks like pretty amazing battery life. And this is something I've been really looking forward to, especially when it comes to laptops. Like, it looks like on the MacBook Air that you'll be able to get up to 18 hours of battery life, which is just, wow. That is amazing on a Mac laptop. I really hope that will be close to a real life use case.
Yeah, so 18 hours of video playback they mentioned. So you can think of it as like you can, I don't know, fly from Brazil to Japan or something and not have to charge your laptop. I mean, most planes these days have outlets, but still, like, this is amazing. Like, it's really, really cool. Even though, like, personally, I don't really care that much about battery power on laptops because I mostly don't use them as laptops. But it's still nice to have.
Yeah, for me, it's all about like just being able to use it in a more like dynamic way or free way. So, for example, with my iPad, I don't always plug it in. Like sometimes I sit in the couch and I use it, or I sit somewhere else in the apartment where I don't have my charger and I just leave it there. And then the next day I just open it up and oh, it still has 80% battery life and I just keep working, right? And that is awesome because if you always have to like constantly charge the device and everything, like, and then you want to use it and it doesn't have any battery left, like that's annoying. So having more battery life for me is just like, just gives you more headroom. That's what it is. Like I probably not going to use these computers 18 hours straight because I typically don't work for 18 hours straight, but it's just great to have it there. Like if you're doing a long trip or if you're out and about, or if you just don't want to charge, like you just want to leave it around the house and just use it. Like that's amazing. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And also some tidbits. This Air still has two USB-C ports. And it also has a P3 wide color display. Now, John, I'm not sure if you'll be able to explain this to me, but weren't the displays already P3? Is P3 wide color different than just P3?
That's a very good question, Rambo. You're really putting me on the spot here. But I'm guessing like, because there was something about the MacBook Air that the display was not as good as the MacBook Pro in the previous iteration. So I guess now it has caught up to be the same quality of display, but I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, all right. Yeah, I think that's probably the case. What tripped me up there was they talked about P3 wide color, but I know it as just P3. So I was wondering if it was something different, but I guess it's just the same display as like my 13-inch MacBook Pro, my non-pro laptop, the same as you have. So
I mean, this thing with colors and displays is getting really complicated, and it goes back to earlier when you don't know the terminology or you don't know the what they're calling these things for a certain thing. Even if it has to do with computers, it gets really confusing. I mean, earlier today, my TV, which is a new TV I have, it asked me if I want to turn on Ultra HD Deep Colors, and I was like, okay, that sounds good. Like, you know, I have no idea what that means. So it's one of those terms where there's so many things when it comes to color technology and displays and all those sorts of things that it just gets really complicated. So if Apple mentioned it during the keynote, I guess it's an improvement over the previous MacBook Air, but these displays are already so good that I don't know if I would be able to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are really good indeed. So I think all that's left for us to talk about the MacBook Air is the price, and it starts at $999.
Yeah, same price, and that's pretty great, right? Like, yep. If Apple keeps the product at the same price, that's a win.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And moving forward, we have what I think is, I mean, besides the name M1, and the PC guy at the end, the surprise of the event, which was the Mac Mini.
Yeah, I was really surprised by that and really happy also. Like the Mac Mini has been a product which has been neglected during certain times. And, you know, there's been a lot of speculation whether it was going to be killed. And then there was that famous line, it remains a product in our lineup, which we love to joke about. But now it's here. Like it's one of the first Macs to be transitioned to Apple Silicon, which I think is just great for the Mac Mini.
Yeah, I think I even heard on other shows way back in the day when this was all just a rumor, like discussions about which Macs would not survive the ARM transition.
Right.
And I think one of the Macs mentioned was the Mac Mini, but here it is. It's still alive and well.
It's still a product in the lineup.
It continues to be a product in our lineup. Yeah, forever. Apparently, I guess. But I was actually chatting to a friend of the show, Mr. Biscuit, which was a guest with us before. Yesterday, and we were actually speculating about maybe Apple would have a Mac Mini, and we were both kind of looking forward to getting Mac Minis. So my plan before the event, and this is where we get into our plans. My plan before the event was to get whatever MacBook Pro they announce, and I was expecting a 16-inch MacBook Pro to be announced. I mean, I wished that it would be announced, but it wasn't. And also, for a Mac Mini to be announced, because I am moving soon and I want to have like a home server at my place. And the Mac Mini is great for that. So I was going to get the Mac Mini for that. But now I've been using my MacBook Pro in clamshell mode for a while, like I think 2 weeks, and I'm liking it.
Ah, there you go. You're starting to become a member of the clamshell club. Welcome, Rambo.
Yeah, and I am getting the Mac Mini.
I am also getting the Mac Mini. Ooh, great minds think alike.
You are getting a Mac Mini.
I think I am. So this is like a kind of 90% decision that I'm at right now. So I do definitely want to get an Apple Silicon Mac. I do have my non-pro laptop still going strong here, sounding like it's going to take off into the upper stratosphere anytime now because the fans are running really, really loud always when I'm podcasting, which is not great. So I've been looking for a new computer and, you know, it's a great reason to upgrade, right? Like you get to use one of the first Apple Silicon chips. It looks to be great. Like it's 3 times faster than the previous model, like the quad-core model. It has 6 times faster graphics, 15 times faster machine learning. Like that looks great. It can only have 16 gigabytes of RAM, I guess is the only limiting factor. But I have 16 gigabytes of RAM currently anyway. So I think for me, it would be a great upgrade because I am also a Clamshell Club member and have been for years. And now I'm not going anywhere, right? I'm at home. And I think that that's going to be for the foreseeable future. So I think buying a desktop computer as the first Apple Silicon Mac makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, like I mentioned, it's much faster than the current Intel version of the Mac Mini, although they didn't say Intel in this part. Here is where you see the difference in form factor, because the MacBook Air is 9 times faster with machine learning, but this one is 15 times faster with machine learning. So I guess that's where the fan comes in.
Yeah, exactly. Because of the fan and because of also like the difference between the integrated graphics, I guess, must have been a limiting factor from the MacBook Air and the Mac Mini, because that's primarily what would be used for machine learning, I suppose. But yeah, because they can run this in a higher kind of thermal envelope, as it's called, then they can run it faster and get better performance out of it. So even if it's the same chip, because it's in a different form factor, we see different performance characteristics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am quite happy with the connectivity aspects of this Mac Mini, which I think stayed pretty much the same in terms of the holes behind the case. But there are a few differences in terms of what's supported and what's not. But it still has 2 USB-C / Thunderbolt ports. It also has 2 USB-A ports, which is cool, like more friendly to old things that you might have around, although I'm fully migrated to USB-C at my place. But anyway, it's nice to have, and still has Ethernet, so that's great. And it actually starts slightly lower than the previous model at just $699. So when I saw the price, and I'm not saying it's cheap, but it's like it's an Apple Silicon Mac you can get for $699, and it's great. It's faster than the MacBook Air, and if you already have the keyboard, mouse, and display, you're good to go.
Yeah, exactly. The price is definitely fantastic. I'm very happy to see that reduction in price. But there are some regressions here in terms of I/O and also kind of customizability options. So there are still 2 USB-C Thunderbolt ports, like you mentioned, but I believe there were more in the previous iteration, or there was at least more ports. I don't know exactly how many there were on of each variant, but there are fewer ports now. And I think this relates to the same chip being used in all models, that the chip can only support a given number of I/O slots, right? So yeah. It using the same I/O controller, so that's a limiting factor. And the same thing goes for RAM as well. So each of these Apple Silicon Macs can only go up to 16 gigabytes of RAM, including the Mac Mini. So where before you could spec it up to, I believe, like 64 gigabytes of RAM, now you can only do 16. And that is a limiting factor of sharing the same chip across these different form factors, which I think we might see going forward. And you were already alluding to this during our poker game, that you thought that they would just have like specific configurations. And even though the RAM is configurable, it's much more limited than what it was before.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are lots of things to unpack here. I think, first of all, the conclusion we can take from all of this is that the compromises of the first generation Apple Silicon Macs is I/O and RAM, right? Those are like the main compromises. And especially the RAM, especially for people who are used to having a certain amount of RAM. Like for me personally, I am perfectly fine with 16 gigs of RAM. I've been doing that for several years, and I like run After Effects and Xcode at the same time here, and I've never seen a problem. It's probably swapping, but I don't notice the swapping, and it will probably be faster with more RAM, but I don't notice it because I don't have more RAM, so I'm fine. But I understand that there are workflows which benefit a lot from having more RAM, and I've even seen people like do RAM disks for Xcode derived data and things like that to speed up builds. So I know that more RAM can definitely be beneficial and will definitely be missing for many people. So yeah, I think those are the main compromises of this first lineup, and probably why we haven't seen like an iMac or a 16-inch MacBook Pro announced today. They're probably working on those, and they will probably have the option to include more RAM than the top RAM, which is 16 gigs for now.
Yeah, exactly. And we might see them even run a different kind of chip, like the M2 or something like that, right? Yeah. Or the M1X. Like it might be a different variant that adds these different I/O capabilities and different RAM capabilities. Because we have to remember here, we're not talking about separate RAM slots anymore. We're talking about integrated shared memory between the CPU and the GPU. So that is a big difference. And I think this is also what's causing this limiting factor. So again, it's not comparing oranges to apples, right? Like no pun intended there, but it's different technologies, right? So we can't just say, oh, it's only 16 gigabytes of RAM and that's comparable to the 16 gigabytes we had before. No, this is different. So it is sad, I think, that we can't go to more than 16 gigabytes. I would love to have been able to spec up a Mac Mini to 32 at least, but it is what it is. And it's just like a side product of this initial generation, this initial rollout, which is, you know, understandably a little bit more limited because you have to start somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to keep in mind that this is the first generation. They announced three Macs with a completely new chip in 2020, like this year. So I think they've done way more than what we were expecting. At least I was expecting like one or two Macs, and they went beyond that. But of course, I'm happy with my 16 gigs here. I understand that people who are accustomed to more RAM might be a little bit disappointed, but there's always next year.
Yeah, exactly. And the lineup will definitely keep expanding and get more dynamic, I think, as time moves on. We still have the 13-inch MacBook Pro to cover. We still have some Ask Stacktrace questions that we want to answer specifically about this event. But first, let's take a very quick break to thank this episode's third and final sponsor.
This week's episode of Stacktrace is also brought to you by Clean My Mac X by our good friends at MacPaw. Clean My Mac X is an all-in-one utility that takes care of your Mac's health. It can identify and remove gigabytes of hidden junk, remove malware, monitor your Mac's performance, and much more. With the Space Lens module, you can instantly see exactly what's consuming your disk space and easily get rid of large and unused files or applications. Prepare your Mac for Big Sur by using Clean My Mac X, which is available on the Mac App Store and on MacPaw's website. Go to macpaw.com/9to5 to get Clean My Mac X with a 30% discount. As we often joke about here on Stacktrace, I have a second 13-inch MacBook Pro that I use to test macOS betas. The problem is that this Mac only has 128GB of SSD, so I've been using Clean My Mac X to find and delete unused files, which usually finds multiple gigabytes of caches that can be safely deleted, allowing me to install the latest Xcode or update to the newest beta. Clean My Mac X can also free up RAM and run maintenance scripts that maximize your Mac's performance, so that you can run your Mac at peak performance, just like it did on day one. Get ready to install macOS Big Sur tomorrow by doing a checkup on your Mac using Clean My Mac X. Go to macpaw.com/9to5 to get Clean My Mac X with a 30% discount. Once again, that's macpaw.com/9to5 to get a 30% discount on Clean My Mac X. Thanks so much to our friends at MacPaw for sponsoring this week's episode of Stack Trace.
All right, Rambo, so we've already talked a fair bit about the MacBook Pro already and that it has active cooling, so it can run with slightly different characteristics compared to the MacBook Air. It features up to 20 hours of battery life, which is 2 hours more even than the MacBook Air because it has presumably a bigger battery. It has 2.8 times faster CPU performance, 5 times faster graphics, and 11 times faster ML compute. One thing that was really interesting when they introduced this product or during the whole like segment of the video was that they mentioned software developers quite a bit. Like they talked about Xcode and compiling code, and I feel like this is kind of their development machine of this initial set of three Macs. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think both the Mac Mini and this one are the developer machines, but especially the MacBook Pro, because I think Apple knows, and anecdotally, I think most developers use laptops. At least that's how I see it. Or even if they don't use it as their main computer, they have a laptop they carry around for conferences and stuff, which are not happening or are happening virtually. But anyway, I think this is definitely the development machine, maybe like also the creative machine for the year. So yeah, I think that's correct.
Yeah, exactly. And this looks like another really solid machine, like good improvements across the board. The same form factor, like we mentioned earlier, so not a redesign or anything like that. Still has two USB ports like before, the touch bar, everything. So just like the same as the other ones, like the M1 chip gives it faster performance. It is also limited in terms of RAM and things like that, but yeah, for anyone who's was in the market for a 13-inch MacBook Pro, this looks like a great option.
Yeah, absolutely. And this would definitely be the one I would be getting if they hadn't announced the Mac Mini. But the Mac Mini stole my heart.
Yeah, I feel the same way, especially given that we're not traveling at the moment. And given that I am always using my computer with an external display, which I really like, I feel like the Mac Mini is also the option for me. But I was very split between these two. Like the MacBook Air was not something I was considering, even if I think it's a great computer, but it's just not for me. I want something with at least a little bit more kind of higher performance ceiling. And the Mac Mini and the MacBook Pro seems to be very, very similar in that sense. Like they seem to have similar numbers and work similarly because they have active cooling and the same chip. But since I am just at my desk and I have an external display, I feel like why not go for the Mac Mini this time and see how that's going to work for me. So yeah, that's kind of my thinking, but I still think this MacBook Pro looks great as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And some other things that happened during the event, I think they also talked about the environment, of course. Fortunately, they didn't say that they're not including a charger with the new Macs.
you don't get a power cable for your Mac Mini.
Well, I'm worried now that that could be the case. I should check.
Right,
the
you have
the
to
website.
Use your iPhone charger to plug it in.
Yeah, so they mentioned up to 60% less power consumption overall, probably from the new architecture, the new overall architecture of the machine. And something which I really like when they are able to do, which is, and you can order it today.
Yeah, it's exciting, isn't it? Like you can immediately order one if you've been waiting and if you know what you're going to get.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this really gets a lot of people buying out of impulse, like right after the Apple event, you're still hyped up and they accept Apple Pay, of course. So you just Face ID or Touch ID and boom, in a few weeks, you'll have your Apple Silicon Mac. I think a lot of people have been ordering these.
I think so too. Maybe the next step would be that if you're watching on your iPhone, for example, there would be a pop-up at the end of the video saying, would you like to buy one of these? And you just say yes, and then it authenticates you with Face ID, and then you 2 days later, you got it in the mail.
That would be quite incredible. Also, macOS Big Sur got a release date. It's not November 11, which proves that I was not lying when I said that I didn't know the release dates and that my release date for AirBuddy had nothing to do with it. Although some people might think that maybe I scheduled it for a day before on purpose, but I totally didn't know the release date. And it's Thursday, November 12th, also known as tomorrow, if you're listening this to this episode, the date it was released.
I was surprised that Apple didn't say something like, and this time, we're giving developers twice the amount of time to prepare their apps for the new Big Sur. We're giving them 2 days instead of one.
Well, to be fair, and I've seen some people comment on this on Twitter, they actually gave us over a week because the release candidate for Big Sur and the latest Xcode was last week.
Yeah.
Actually, they've been approving updates with Apple Silicon support already, and FusionCast is already up in the App Store with an ARM slice on the binary. So that's fun.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I think they did it the right way this time for sure. Yeah. And I was just kidding there. but it's just kind of funny how these releases now happen so quickly after the event. But this was definitely the right way to do it, to give the developers the tools they need to submit the builds beforehand and then make the announcement, right? So then you at least know that the announcement is coming very, very quickly if there's a release candidate. So then it's not a surprise when they announce it that it's going to be in 2 days, because you've already been able to submit your build.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And then the final thing is that we had that fun post-credit scene with the PC guy from the previous Apple commercials that they were running. That must be like 10 years ago or something now, when they were using like, hi, I'm a Mac. Hi, I'm a PC.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I love those. They're really a fun comedy, and the characters are great and the actors are great, and I'm really happy that they managed to bring this back as like a homage for those days. And I think probably many people watching didn't know what it was about.
Yeah.
Because yeah, there's a lot of younger people who don't know about the I'm a Mac, I'm a PC campaign. Probably all of our listeners do, but yeah, I laughed a lot when the guy appeared, and it was a funny little skit.
Yeah, it really was. I loved it. So more of that. I love when Apple is a little bit like funny, and you know, when they're not taking themselves too seriously, because so often these presentations can get so formal and so serious. It's fun when they throw in a little bit of comedy, even if it is at the very end.
Absolutely.
All right, Rambo. So of course, we also have to end this episode with some Ask Stacktrace. So just to remind everybody, you can always ask us questions about what we're doing, anything that's going on in the news in terms of tech, or anything in particular that you'd like us to talk about, by tweeting with the hashtag Ask Stacktrace, or by emailing us on stacktrace@9to5mac.com. And this week, you, Rambo, actually tweeted and asked for some questions specifically about the Apple event. So we already answered a lot of those questions, I think, during our discussion, specifically around why are these new Apple Silicon Macs all limited to 16 gigabytes of RAM, the I/O situation, and so on and so forth. So we're not going to answer those questions again here, but thanks a lot to anyone who asked us questions about that or about any other topic. But we have two questions that we would love to answer specifically here, and then we can also follow up with some more questions when we learn more as well during following episodes. So our first question comes from Elise, and Elise wants to know if we think that these announcements will also help the iPad ecosystem as well, now that Pro apps will support the ARM architecture as well. So Rambo, what do you think about this? Do you think that the transition to Apple Silicon will eventually also help improve the iPad ecosystem?
I think we briefly mentioned this before, and I really don't see that big a relationship, and mainly because architecture hasn't really been a thing in recent years. Like, developers don't usually have to worry about the architecture their apps are running in. And you've seen from the video Apple presented, and also from my own experience, most Mac apps, even complex ones, just took a rebuild in Xcode to be compatible with Apple Silicon.
Yeah.
So it's not the architecture that's holding Pro apps back. If I had to point my finger at like one thing that's holding the entire iOS ecosystem back in terms of Pro apps, it would be App Store policies.
Yeah.
And we actually have a story we're going to probably talk about next week relating to that with the Ish emulator that was taken down and then put up again. I think App Store policies are holding back the platform in terms of Pro apps way more than anything related to architecture. That said, like, I don't know, maybe like Adobe with Photoshop is going to have to optimize some of their algorithms for the new architecture, because I think when you get to the level of Photoshop, then architecture starts making a difference. And also with the Neural Engine now being available on Macs as well, maybe some developers who were previously not looking at the Neural Engine will start using it, and that could translate to better models on iOS as well to do other types of things that we can't do today. So it's hard to say for sure, but in general, I don't think it's going to be a big jump in that sense.
Yeah, I think that you're right in saying that the architecture itself will not make this kind of improvement happen to the iPad. But I do think that there's another thing at play here, and that's that the platforms are slowly but steadily kind of getting unified. And I know that there's this famous slide from a couple of WWCs ago, like, are we merging the Mac and iOS? No, we're not. But at the same time, they are creating these universal binaries now. They are running iOS apps on the Mac and so on. Like, the gap is definitely getting smaller and smaller. And I think that can have a side effect in the long term, where if we start looking at our apps, not so much as Mac apps or iOS apps, but just as Apple platform apps, and we just ship them on different form factors and they run on different devices, then that, I think, could really help the iPad ecosystem become a lot richer, because then developers would not start thinking about, oh, I'm going to build a powerful Mac app. Like, think about if you're going to start build something like Photoshop today, you wouldn't probably just build it for the Mac. You would use some of these new technologies, whether it's like Swift UI or Catalyst, or whether it is the fact that all of them run the same architecture, like all these kind of cross-platform shared technologies between all of Apple's platforms, you would probably utilize that to bring your app to the entire ecosystem. And I think that will help the iPad in the long run. Not so much the ARM transition itself, but rather like the other things that come along with it.
Yeah, that's definitely something that could happen. Absolutely.
Cool. And the second question that we are going to answer on this episode comes from Ayush. And Ayush wants to hear if these new Macs support Windows. Do they, Rambo?
It's complicated. Or maybe our favorite answer, it depends.
Right.
So support Windows, the short answer is no. So you can't just install Windows on Apple Silicon Macs. Like, just install Windows. No, you can't.
Just put in the CD. Well, there's no CD drive.
Yeah, so you cannot run Windows directly on these Macs, but you can run Parallels or VMware or Docker. Like, they even demoed Docker running on WWDC. So if you are like a developer and you rely on virtualization to do your work, like, I have Docker running right now as we speak because I have my website running locally so that I can develop it. I'll still be able to do this on my new Mac Mini once I have it. If you are someone who uses like Parallels or VMware just to run like one Windows app from like your bank or the government or something that doesn't exist for the Mac, you'll still be able to do that. For people who actually like install Windows on the Mac and run it as like a Windows machine, those people are going to be out of luck for the time being, at least.
Yeah, but this is something that could also change in the future, right? Like, because there is Windows for ARM, it's just not supported. Microsoft is supporting it on certain platforms, but not on the Mac, like not on Apple Silicon specifically. So if also Microsoft is going to start transitioning to ARM eventually, like, you know, getting Windows to support ARM more generally, then we could see something like that for like something like Bootcamp come back to the Mac. And I'm sure that Apple would love that because it is a benefit for the Mac to be able to also run Windows for those users that need it. For example, for gaming, right? So if you have a Mac Pro, especially like I can imagine a Apple Silicon powered Mac Pro with all of these like numbers translating to Mac Pro numbers, that would be a pretty good gaming computer, even though it would probably cost like $1 million. But anyway, so that is definitely something that I think they would like, but it's not here yet because of Apple or because of Microsoft or because the two, or because they just didn't have time yet. Who knows? So I'm still hoping that we will see a return of Bootcamp in the future for our Macs, but it's just not here at the moment.
Yeah, I wonder if it will maybe even be possible for Apple to like develop a first party virtualization thing where like you do boot into a macOS shell, but it instantly runs Windows in a virtualization environment with like a very thin layer so that it's basically running Windows. Because we've seen that the virtualization on these chips will be possible and potentially quite fast. So I wonder if that could be the solution. Of course, it wouldn't solve the problem for people who really need like bare metal performance Windows running on Mac. But I think, I don't know, I think there are better options out there if your goal is to run Windows on a machine directly than Macs. Like Macs have great hardware, but they have been tuned for macOS, so maybe go get a PC. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. So that's our episode for this week. Hope you enjoyed our discussion around the latest Apple event, around the new Apple Silicon Macs, and so on and so forth. We love talking to you every week, and thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks also a lot to our three great sponsors, App Figures, Honey Badger, and MacPaw. Thanks again a lot to everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.